Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I appreciate you joining me as we look back at the baseball cards that not only I collected, but probably you collected, or maybe still collect these days. And if you're listening to us in the Northeast, or actually much of the North, I hope you're thawing out while you're listening to this podcast. If you're anywhere else, I hope you're ready for spring. It is officially here, and that means baseball season just several days away. And if you are a collector, even if you're like me, you don't collect quite with the tenacity you did when you were younger. It's still a fun time because the baseball cards are fresh, the designs are new, and it's just neat to get all amped up for the season. And I'm amped up about this podcast because, as you know, we're in the Big Old Binder now. Our first look at the Big Old Binder came from 1954. Now, I don't have cards from 1955 or 56, at least for the time being, but I do have 1957 tops. And from here on out, we'll be going from 1957 up through 1980. And the 57 top set was a groundbreaking set for a number of reasons I'll get into later on in the podcast. But our random pull, and I'll be honest, it's not extremely, honestly random. I have three cards from 1957. And a couple of the players, well, one of the players is Robin Roberts, who is very well known. Another one is Bob Niemann, who is not well known. He was with the Baltimore Orioles. But I specifically picked this one because he was an outstanding player. He was part of a groundbreaking moment, not only in baseball history, but really United States history. And I've got a fun little story about how I got to this card, and I'll share that with you later. Card number 30 from the 1957 top set, that would be one, Harold Reese, or as we know him much, much better, the late Pee Wee Reese. And there's an interesting story behind his nickname, of course. Several different stories behind his nickname. We'll take a stab in the dark as to which one is actually accurate. But Pee Wee Reese, of course, a lifetime, at least when he got to the major league level, a lifetime member of the Dodgers, was in Brooklyn throughout the uprising of the Dodgers in the 40s and 50s, and yes, did play for them in Los Angeles in 1958. But a great player to have, and like I said, I specifically selected this card from the three that I have for a number of reasons. And oh, by the way, if you look at the picture of this card, and you can see it, you know, on our Audio Boom player, or even in the tweets that we send out at Wax and Gum Stains, this one has seen a few battles, or at the very least, the inside of some pockets, because this is not a gem mint card by any stretch of the imagination. But as I mentioned in the 1954 Tops podcast, I don't care. You know, when it comes to older cards, if you end up with one that's in, you know, if not gem mint, but, you know, very good condition, then that's great. I mean, you look at these cards, they're 60 years old. But I'm totally fine with, you know, some cards that have rounded corners and creases, because to me, I'm a baseball fan and a history buff, and just being able to hold on to this piece of history is thrilling to me. So make fun of me all you want for having the very, 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 very worn 1957 Topps Pee Wee Reese card. But there's a lot of stories behind this, which I will get to. First, we're going to get to your comments on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. We had a lot of great reaction to our 54 Tops set. Also, our new Flashback Friday editions. In case you didn't catch it in our last episode, we're just doing, at least for the time being, that may change over the summer when things slow down a little bit for me during the hockey offseason. But at least for now, we're going to be releasing the new podcast on Tuesdays via Audio Boom and iTunes. So you can catch that, set your clock, if you will, circle the calendar every Tuesday. You look forward to it. Meanwhile, on Friday, we will be re-releasing some of our archive shows, Flashback Friday shows, and we'll do it on Friday, but also send out some Twitter reminders on Saturday and Sunday that this episode is worth listening to once again. And our first Flashback Friday edition went back to the 88 Donruss set, which is a set that is much maligned. Of course, it's the poster child of the junk wax era. But I don't think it should be as derided as it is. Yes, there's a gazillion of those cards still out there, but I still like the design of the card, and it was actually a very nice card if it wasn't for, you know, literally cases upon cases of products still being out there nearly 30 years later. So we started that. For one, it gives me a little bit of a breather, but also, especially for all of our new listeners, it gives you a chance to catch up on some of our older episodes. This episode is episode number 70. I'm proud to have 70 episodes under our belt. I honestly thought when we started this that maybe you get 10 episodes. And in fact, in episode one, I joked that this will probably just die a horrible death after 5 weeks. But here we are. Let's see, 7 months later? Yeah, 7 months later, 70 episodes in the books. So we want to give you a chance to go back and listen to some of these. And if you didn't hear the 88 Donruss podcast or some other ones the first time around, we will go ahead and push them out to you on every Friday. So let's talk a little bit about the 54 Tops set. And we got a note from C&M Collectibles. And, you know, you look at the picture of the card of Joe Coleman. And again, that is Joe Coleman Sr., not Joe Coleman Jr., his son, who is, it was probably better known. He had a longer career in the major leagues and is still currently a pitching coach. But C&M Collectibles says a lot of cards look like they were in bicycle spokes. That 54 Coleman looks like it was in the tailpipe of a motorcycle. Well, I think the tailpipe is a little too harsh. It still has most of its white color, but it's been through a lot. But again, you know, cards like this, I'm just happy to have it. And, you know, maybe it's 50 cents to buy it. But, you know, again, for me, being a baseball fan, being a history fan, and you know, being a collector, just having one of these cards, even though it's not in gem mint condition or anywhere near it, I'm totally fine with that. So make fun of me all you want. Go ahead, because you're going to see some pretty beat up cards over the next few podcasts here. But I just don't care if it's in, you know, passable shape. And I really do think that the Pee Wee Reese card we're going to talk about is actually in worse condition than that Joe Coleman card. By the way, C&M Collectibles also following up with a nice comment here. Definitely worth a listen for all of us who bought 100 count prospect lots of Todd Van Poppel and Tony Mandarich. Well done, Hobby Podcast. Well, thank you again. You've had some very kind comments about the program over the last couple of weeks. And Mandarich is one thing, but Todd Van Poppel, you know, if 88 Donruss is the poster child of the junk wax era, Todd Van Poppel, to no fault of his own, is the poster child of overhyped rookie sensations. He's right up there with Kevin Moss, Hensley Mullins, Brian Jordan, DJ Dozier, you name it. There's plenty of, rookies and young prospects from the late 80s and early 90s where, because of the baseball card hobby and in the industry, because we talked so much about the value of those cards, we all thought that they were going to be star players. So we all invested a lot of money in the Brian Taylor cards. There's another one. There's quite a few Yankees from the early 90s I'm bringing up there. Let me see. Brian Taylor, Eddie Zosky. Well, that was another one. I was a Blue Jays fan. Eddie Zosky was supposed to be the next great thing, and that certainly didn't pan out. We've all gone through the stage of getting way too many prospects or rookies that didn't quite pan out the way they did. But it brings back some great memories, though. You know, if you open up a pack and you see Todd Van Poppel, you go, oh, because you're thinking, Todd Van Poppel, man, that card, 1991, if you pulled that, you know, that was worth like $5 right out of the pack now, maybe 5 cents. If you're lucky enough. A nice thought here from Christian Anderson. Love that you spent so much time talking about Bill Veeck. And the book Vec as in Rec, big reader of baseball books. That is a favorite. Well, I'm glad you like it too, Christian. And I'm a big reader. And even though I'm very busy with my work right now, I still find some time, at least maybe twice a week, to wind down the day and read a few chapters of a book. And my reading habits, you know, like I've said, I'm a baseball fan and I'm a history fan. Well, I'm also just a sports fan in general. So I read a lot of sports books. But I tend to alternate. I'll read like a sports book, and then I'll read a political book. And then I'll go back to a sports book, and then I'll go to some kind of history book. And, you know, I just kind of alternate back and forth. I'm actually right now reading this 750-plus page book on the 40-year history of Saturday Night Live, which, even though it's a hefty read, it's been very entertaining. I'm about 125 pages into it. But yeah, Vec as in Rec, that was one that I actually bought probably 20, 25 years ago at a used bookstore, read once before, and then came around and read it a second time a couple months ago and just absolutely enjoyed it. Same thing, and one of our listeners actually posted a picture of Harry Carey's Holy Cow. That was his autobiography, which he penned in, I want to say, 88 or 89. And that's a great read, too. And it was the same situation where I bought it when I was, I think, a senior in high school, and then 20 years later decided to read it again and got so much more out of the second reading. So, you know, there's some books there. I will also throw out a few other titles if you're interested in baseball books. One of my all-time favorites is called Seasons in Hell by Mark Shropshire. He was a beat reporter for the Texas Rangers. I forget which newspaper. I think it was a newspaper in Fort Worth, Texas. And he was the beat reporter there from 73 through 75, and the Texas Rangers back then, to put it nicely, were a very screwed up bunch on and off the field. The Texas Rangers were just a daily train wreck. And when you're a beat reporter and you have to cover a bad baseball team for 162 games a year, you can imagine, you know, certainly by the end of year two, you've been through the ringer so much. You've got a lot of great stories, and you meet everything in the world with all sorts of sarcasm. So, you know, Seasons in Hell is a good one. Of course, Jim Boughton, Ball Four, is another great one. In fact, that's due for me for a rereading. It's been a while since I've read that one. And, you know, Bronx Zoo by Sparky Lyle is pretty good. Bless You Boys from Sparky Anderson, his diary on the 1984 Tigers season. Of course, they won the World Series then. That's a pretty good read as well. So those are the first ones that come off the top of my head, but I'm sure there's, you know, if I went into my room, there's probably five or six more I could think of. So if you're interested in baseball books, there's a few of them to go and check out and read for the first time or reread once again. Now, I've got an interesting comment about the Texas Rangers, courtesy of Pasquale Prezioso. He sent us a picture on Friday, a picture of a VHS videotape. For those of you who are under the age of 30, that's how we used to get our entertainment. And it's a cover of a videotape which says, "The original Baseball Card Video Company, Inc. presents an introduction to baseball card collecting." So as if that doesn't look cheesy enough, then you look at the bottom of the box cover. Host / narrator, Major League Manager, Bobby Valentine. And I saw that and I went, oh, geez, this is going to be a doozy. And I've mentioned before, I've met Bobby Valentine in person during one of my many spring training visits to Port Charlotte, Florida, when the Texas Rangers were there. And after first class ass clown Kevin Brown gave me a dirty look, Bobby Valentine addressed me and my friends who were there as a member of a Boy Scout troop who were the color guard that day. You know, he said in his Bobby Valentine voice, "Oh, you kids, you having fun today? Just make sure you're not talking to the players because, you know, some of them are having some private time here." And that's the one thing about Bobby Valentine that would drive me crazy is he's got this really hypnotic, sleep-inducing voice, and I'm trying not to sound mean, but I mean, that's just his voice. It's just this really casual, almost Kermit the Frog smoking a joint kind of voice. And that's just how it is. And I watched this video, not that I have a VCR player right in front of me, but I searched YouTube, and thank God for YouTube, because the most amazing things are still floating around the internet with YouTube, including a copy of this video. And it's 30 minutes. And I actually, watched it and thought, okay, I'm really in for a treat, you know, much like a bloody car crash here. But it was actually not that bad of a video. If you look at our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed, you'll see the link to the YouTube video. I actually responded to Pasquale's tweet by retweeting it and quoting it with the YouTube link. So I would suggest you check it out. You don't need to watch the whole thing because it's because it is hypnotic, pot smoking sounding, Kermit the Frog-ish, Bobby Valentine narrating the whole thing. But it was made in 1988. And, you know, you have 1988 technology here and 1988 video production standards going on. So it's a little bit of a flashback with that. But I have to be honest with the content of the video, which talks a little bit about the history of baseball cards and the grading of baseball cards and, you know, how you maintain your collection. I have to say it was actually very well done. It was not too goofy. It was not too hokey. It was a little campy, but again, this was something that was clearly made for kids and families in 1988. So, you know, you do have this kind of a cheesecloth effect to a lot of the video in there. But, you know, with that said, even though there was a little bit of a campy feel to it, it was actually well done. It was not embarrassing. And when I first saw the picture of the video, I thought, okay, this is going to be a humdinger. But it was actually very well done, so I will give them that. And I think of a few other neat things from that video. First of all, it's 1988. So this is the first really complete year of junk wax. You know, some people will say, you know, the junk wax era started in 87 or 86, but I think we can all agree 1988 was just deep in the heart of the junk wax era, and it didn't get any better for a few years. But 88 was the first year where all of the card companies went way too far in production. They didn't really put out really good cards that year. So, you know, the 88 year for collecting was not that great. Well, then the fact that you have, 3 or 4 million of each card being produced then, we all know 1988 was just the very beginning of the clunker times known as the junk wax era. Well, what's funny is there's a scene, and it's very early in the video if you watch the YouTube version of it. Bobby Valentine is in, I don't know if it's an actual baseball card shop. I think it might be, because they give credit to a few shops for letting them shoot video there. Or it was just on a soundstage and they brought all of these, boxes of cards as props. But he's standing at a counter, and behind him are shelves just chock full of 88 cards. So you have boxes of Fleer, you have boxes of Donruss, you have boxes of Topps. And, you know, those of us who collect, you know, 88 Donruss, there it is. It's just piles and piles of these cards and Topps and Fleer. And you're like, oh, geez. Yeah. You know, on one hand, you're going, wow, look, here's a picture of a 52 Topps wax pack. Or, you know, hey, here's a 57 Stan Musial that they're flipping over and you know, just manhandling. You know, if you got a Stan Musial card from then, it's bolted down in very thick plastic. But, you know, you look at it and you go, well, that was the beginning of the end there. Bobby Valentine, you know, snoozing us with his discussion of the mountains of baseball cards from 1988 behind him. But something else that's neat is because 88 was the year that Score started, it was also a predecessor to Upper Deck in 1989. And they show, you know, they say, you know, now there's Topps and Fleer and Donruss and Score came up with a set this year. They also mentioned Sports Flicks, which they were at the end of the line by 1988. But then, you know, he says, you know, there's also a new set coming out called Upper Deck. And the card they show is the Dwayne Bice prototype, the promo card. And if you listen back to our podcast on 89 Upper Deck, you'll find out how influential Dwayne Bice was to the creation of Upper Deck and some of the headaches that they had as a company a little later on down the line. But, you know, Dwayne Bice, who was pretty much just a journeyman relief pitcher, you know, cashed in big by helping Upper Deck get the licenses that they needed. So it was kind of neat that the one card that they showed, because of course the set hadn't come out yet, but the one card that they showed was the promo card that Dwayne Bice, you know, allowed the usage of his image for, to help sell the card to the Major League Baseball Players Association and then eventually to dealers later on in the history of the company. So that was kind of neat. But anyways, yeah, the video, like I said, you know, it is from 1988, so you're going to see a lot of cards that you wish you didn't have anymore. And you're also going to see, you know, a little bit of outdated, you know, video technology here. But I will say, content-wise, it was actually very well done. But also, it's a neat little time capsule. As I like to remind people, there was life before the internet. So you'll get to see how people used to keep track of cards and values of cards before the internet, you know, with the printed Beckett monthly price guide, with the annual price guide book that came out. And it's kind of neat how that all came through there. One last thought from Wax Pack 916 in response to our 88 Donruss Flashback Friday show. Listening to this again, your description of the design made me think of school portraits from the 90s. With lasers in the background, yes. And let me tell you what, Wax Pack 916, it wasn't just the 90s. It happened in the late 80s. It's actually rather appropriate because I remember in 1988, the 88-89 school year was the sixth grade for me. And I remember my picture from that year featuring fat, chubby me. You know, I had grown out but not up yet. Fat, chubby me with my bad buzz cut. And I was placed in front of one of those laser light show backdrops. So it's very, very accurate there. Yeah, I didn't even think of the old, you know, school portrait backdrops. So great point there. We always have a fun conversation at Wax and Gum Stains. A whole lot of other conversations over the last few weeks, including a fun look at some of the rediscovered Topps cards that some of our listeners have found. Also, Kevin Hickerson showing the haul from the 91 Topps box that he bought a couple weeks ago. So anytime you want to talk about the hobby, be it the podcast we do or the sets that we talk about or the players that we talk about or just anything about the hobby in general, please do so at Wax and Gum Stains. And again, please remind all of your collecting friends not only about our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, but also that we have new podcasts on Tuesdays, Flashback Friday editions, appropriately on Fridays, and we'll remind you about them throughout the weekend. And you can find Wax Ecstatic on Audioboom and iTunes. And again, we should have some news about another platform that you can hear the show on very, very soon. I'm still waiting for an official word. Haven't gotten it yet, but should be coming any moment now. So as soon as we hear about it, we'll share the news with you at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. All right, let's take a look at 1957 Topps. This is a set that I'm going to have to go back and try to collect a few more from. And of course, when you're talking about a 60-year-old set, there's only so many cards that are out there. But the 57 Topps set is one of my favorites because if there was ever a set through photography that can take you back in time, and you kind of get the feeling, I mean, when you look at some of these pictures, you can almost smell the ballpark and the peanuts roasting and the popcorn popping and the grass, and especially some of these older ballparks, like, you know, the old Yankee Stadium. You can almost smell the old metal and concrete and, you know, maybe wood bleachers of these older ballparks and some of these cards because the photography is so good. This is a great set, and it is a groundbreaking set, one, because of the photography, but also because of the cards themselves. Now, the 57 Topps set was 407 cards, so much smaller than a lot of the card sets that we see these days. But again, in 1957, you only had 16 major league teams. Rosters did not flex as much. You didn't have the craze on rookie players. So, you know, you had a pretty steady list of players that were going to be playing. Now, the 57 top set is not only 407 cards, but it also comes through five series. And it's a very strange arrangement of a number of cards in series. And for whatever reason, the fourth series of the five is the toughest to collect now. For whatever reason, there were fewer cards made in the fourth series, even less than the fifth series, reportedly, which is unusual because normally you had fewer and fewer cards from first series to second, and then second to third, and then third and fourth, all the way down to the last series. So collectors trying to get a complete set here have had a real bear of a time trying to lock up the final, or not the final, I'm sorry, those 88 cards in series four, and they've actually had better luck getting the final 55 cards in series five. So that's one of the unique quirks about this set. Some of the standout cards, some great rookies in this set. Of course, the most notable would be Brooks Robinson and also Frank Robinson. Plus, you have Jim Bunning, Don Drysdale, Rocky Colavito, and you've got your normal assortment of various stars, young stars, and veteran stars as well. And with Bowman out of the picture for 2 years here, Topps had just exclusive run of the players who were available. So you didn't miss too many players that were playing in the major leagues at this point in time. Now, two reasons why the set was groundbreaking. First, as I mentioned, the photography. This was the first time that Topps used full-color photographs on the front of the cards. Now, we had seen in previous editions, and we didn't talk about 55 and 56, but you would have maybe a real color portrait of a player as part of the design of the card. Or when we mentioned 1954, there was a black and white photograph that was part of the front of the card design. But in 1957, they went with totally photographs of players. No cartoons, no artwork, nothing. And as I mentioned, you know, maybe it's Kodachrome they were shooting these with. I don't know. But the photo technology of the day, you can feel 1957 every time you look at these cards. There's an incredible bit of life that these photos provide. And it really provides a neat time capsule. For those of you who are old enough to remember that time, then it's a nice walk down memory lane. For those of us who are too young to remember that time, in fact, this is 20 years before my time, it's a neat time capsule. It's a way to travel back and look at some great players and great teams throughout baseball history. So the photography was the big thing here. And Topps would occasionally mix in some artwork. I know, especially in the 1958 set, they kind of went half and half with real portraits and artwork portraits on the front of the cards. Sometimes you would have cards that were just artwork because they didn't have a photo on hand, so they would dummy up a picture and try to make it look lifelike, and they often failed with that, especially in the 1970s. They had a few cards where not just the player uniforms, but the players themselves were basically airbrushed onto the cards. Now, with the great photography leads to a great simple design. It is a classic in that the photograph dominates the entire front of the card, and in fact, if we look at the front of this Pee Wee Reese card, if you squint a little and look past all the creases that this particular card has gathered over the years, I mean, here we have Pee Wee Reese doing just a simple ground ball fielding pose here. And you can see that the picture does take up about 95% of the card. You've got a little bit of a white border. And then at the bottom, it's just the player's name, the team he plays for, and his position. So there you go. That was the simple design there, and collectors love it because, unlike a lot of today's cluttered cards, and that's not a knock against today's cards, but, you know, you've got all sorts of design elements and logos and angles and colors and refractors and all that stuff. This was simply all about photography with a little bit of space to identify who the player was and what team he played for. So I've always liked it because of its simplicity. Now, before we get to the back of the card, something else that made the 1957 set groundbreaking and still in effect today is the size of the card. This was the first time that a baseball card was set at 2.5 inches by 3.5 inches. And with the exception of the 89 Bowman set, That has been the standard size of a base baseball card set. So for 60 years now, baseball cards have remained very much unchanged in terms of size and also in the use of photography, color photography on the front as opposed to artwork to try to gauge your interest there. Now, something else that was groundbreaking in this particular set was on the backs of the cards. Where in the past, and we showed this to you in our 1954 podcast, and you would see this too in 55 and 56, in 1957, Topps got away from cartoons. They just opted for stats and trivial tidbits. And Pee Wee Reese, because he had such a lengthy career, all you had was stats on the back. But if you look in the back of the card, you see the upper left-hand corner, you've got the Topps logo, again, that Wild Wild West typeface that I love. You have the card number, you have the player's name and personal information along the top. And then you have just a little bit of a blurb about his career. And it's kind of hard to read on this because, again, the card's been through so many various pockets, bike spokes, and Lord knows what else. But it just says, Pee-wee has become the Dodgers' spark plug for 15 years. He's one of the finest fielders and timeliest hitters in baseball. And then you have the complete Major League batting record, and there it is. It's all just right there, just Brooklyn from 1940 to 1956. And something that I like seeing in the complete Major League record, and something that you would see a lot of in the cards from the 1950s that did this, is you see the military service in World War II. So you've got a line for 40, 41, and 42. But then you have a line that says 43-5, so 1943 to 45. And it still says Brooklyn next to his name, but then you go to the stats and it says in parentheses, in U.S. Navy. And that is just a reminder about the sacrifice that a lot of players made. It's not just a sacrifice. You know, some players did suffer injuries or had to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder and shell shock and stuff like that, but also to their playing careers. You know, Pee Wee Reese lost 3 years of his professional playing career while serving in World War II. Ted Williams, very famously, not only lost time in World War II, but he also served in Korea, nearly died in a plane crash in Korea. So you often forget all these years later about the military service that these players had to go through during a very, very difficult time, not only in the United States, but in the world. So that's a neat little note. You know, here we are now 70 plus years since the end of World War II. And to see that little reminder there, it's kind of a stark reminder as to the realities of the world. There was still baseball and there were still baseball players, but a lot of them were serving overseas in the name of freedom, not only for our nation, but for nations across the world. So if there's one word to describe the 1957 Topps set, it is simple. Great photography, very simple design on the front. Like I said, just mostly picture, a little space for a name and a team name. And then on the back, very simple too. Just the facts, ma'am. If there was ever a Joe Friday set, this was it. You just had a picture, you had a name, you had a team, you had stats on the back, and there you go. And while that could be seen as boring, in fact, when you look back at some of the sets from the 80s and 90s where it was just a picture and stats and really nothing flashy to it, there is just an incredible innocence to how simple this card is. And I think a lot of it has to do with the photography. If you get a chance, and again, you can even just do Google images on this. Just type in 1957 Topps Baseball. You look at some of these pictures, and it's just such a fresh, clean look. There's nothing crazy about it. And that is a departure from what Topps had done over the previous few years, you know, with the portraits and with the artwork and, you know, mixing in a real life photograph with a piece of artwork on the front of a card. Here, it was just the picture. And you had some pretty neat pictures that can take you back to 1957 just with one glance. All right, now a little bit of a story about this particular card. I found it, I want to say about 20 years ago. Even though I was not collecting new cards back then, I was still occasionally buying old cards. And I remember going to a garage sale, and I was with my mother, and I have no idea why we went to this garage sale. Now, back in the day, you could look up garage sale listings in your newspaper, And if they were selling baseball cards, they would list it. And then, you know, if you want to try to find some good deals on baseball cards, you'd go to a garage sale, because some people, they just wanted to get rid of the cards. They just really didn't care about, you know, trying to, you know, make a mint off of them. They just wanted them out of the house and take a few bucks for them. And now I often wonder what else was in the box of cards that I was shuffling through that day. Because, you know, this is 1996, 97, whenever it was. And here I am just pulling 57 Topps cards out. So there's a little bit of regret going, I probably should have gone through that box a little more. But something that may have held me back is I probably only had a couple dollars on me. So I couldn't exactly, you know, drop $30 or $40 on a box of vintage cards back then. But instead of playing woulda, coulda, shoulda, I'll remind you that, you know, even on a limited budget, I still bought some older cards. And there was this nice old gentleman who had just a box of cards. And I saw, and it was in a, you know, a plastic card holder. So it's not like it was just an old shoe box of cards held together by a rubber band. And here it was. It was just this card, 1957 Topps, number 30, Pee Wee Reese. And I think I bought it for maybe 50 cents because, as you could see, it is just thoroughly beaten up. But I didn't care. And I've said it before a couple times just in this podcast. I don't really care too much about the condition of the older cards. It's just neat to have them. But it was neat to have a card with a Brooklyn Dodger. And now there's a lot of love for the Brooklyn Dodgers because not only is that team not in existence anymore, but, you know, the feeling for nostalgia of, you know, Ebbets Field. I mean, that's been around for a long time, but the nostalgia for Ebbets Field, the nostalgia for, you know, the recently retired Vin Scully, who started his career in Brooklyn and then, of course, followed the Dodgers out to L.A., the nostalgia of the idea of a Major League Baseball team in Brooklyn. What? You know, I know you've got the Brooklyn Nets now, but, you know, that's just so artsy-fartsy trendy. You know, it's, you know, oh, we should have a team in Brooklyn. You know, Brooklyn was so different in the 1940s and 50s. And I know because my dad was born and raised in Brooklyn. He's told me many, many stories about following the Dodgers and going to Ebbets Field. You know, he would have been 13 years old when they won the World Series in 1955. And, you know, much like the Whalers were to Hartford, you know, the Nordique were to Quebec City, or to use another small city example, like the Packers are to Green Bay. There was a very unique tie to Brooklyn and the Dodgers because you had the over-dominating Yankees taking all the headlines then. You had the Giants who would occasionally win a World Series and steal the spotlight away from the Yankees. But then you had the ho-hum Dodgers who were a pretty bad team for a long time. But then post-war, they started getting good. They started winning pennants, but they just couldn't beat the Yankees. And of course, the very baseball-centric phrase, wait till next year. That was pretty much the motto of the Brooklyn Dodgers because they were a really good team for a long time, but they just couldn't beat the Yankees and win the World Series until 1955. And then, as you know, 2 years later, Walter O'Malley, looking for greener pastures, looking for a new ballpark. You know, what's old is new again. You're always finding owners that want a new ballpark or they threaten to leave. Well, they move out to Los Angeles. The Dodgers, of course, move out to San Francisco at the same time. And, you know, Brooklynites were just lost without their team. And you weren't just going to become a fan of the Yankees. Why would you do that? You hated the Yankees all your life. I'm supposed to become a fan of them because they're the only team there? Puh, whatever. So, you know, my dad would tell me stories about how he and his dad used to get on a train. They go to Philadelphia. They go to Connie Mack Stadium and watch the Phillies play the Dodgers. So, you know, Brooklynites were still fans of the Dodgers, even though they were in Los Angeles, and it took a few years for them to wean themselves off the Dodgers. And then many of them became Mets fans once the Mets came around in 1962 because, well, A, you didn't have to be a Yankees fan, and B, you had National League ball once again. So, you know, just having something tangible from that time period with a Brooklyn Dodger on it was just a great thing for me. So without hesitation, without worrying about just how crappy of a condition this card was in, I bought it on the spot. I've had it ever since, and I absolutely love it because, you know, while there's a lot of nostalgia for the Brooklyn Dodgers and while there's a lot of nostalgia for Pee Wee Reese and Ebbets Field and everything associated with the Brooklyn Dodgers, unlike a lot of things that are out there today that are recreations, you know, I could get a facsimile Brooklyn Dodgers hat or Brooklyn Dodgers jersey or Brooklyn Dodgers pennant, but to actually have something that was produced in 1957, their last year in Brooklyn, to have it in my possession and to have it be, you know, one of the outstanding players of that team. And, you know, in their time in Brooklyn, you could argue the best shortstop that the Dodgers ever had was always appealing to me. So even though it is beat up, I absolutely love this card. And of course, the player involved, one Harold Peter Henry Reese, again, better known as Pee Wee Reese, that made the card even more valuable to me because I heard a lot of great stories about him too. And, you know, Pee Wee Reese was not only a very good baseball player, he had a career average of .269, over 2,000 hits, 126 home runs, but better known for his fielding and his speed too. He was actually the National League stolen base leader in 1952, but also he was a two-time World Series champion with him, not only as a player in 1955, but as a coach in 1959. So he moved with the Dodgers to L.A. in 58, played for them that one season, then became a coach for them and won a World Series there. But also he was a 10-time All-Star. He was an All-Star in 1942, and then from 46 to 54, he represented the National League at the shortstop position. So not only was he a good player, but it's very well known about what he did when Jackie Robinson was brought into the major leagues. Now, there is, you know, some differing of opinions as to how close Reese and Robinson were. And it's safe to assume that Pee Wee Reese, when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in 1947, Pee Wee Reese didn't just run across the field with open arms and give him a big hug and say, "Hey, here, you big fellow, here, come with me." It wasn't like that. There was an aloofness to this for a couple of reasons. One, Pee Wee Reese was a native of Kentucky. And as you are probably well aware of, especially in the 1920s and 30s, as Pee Wee Reese was being raised in Kentucky, not exactly a friendly place for African Americans. But he didn't really associate himself with African Americans back then because, you know, Kentucky and a lot of the South, and you could argue much of the nation, was so segregated that while in some places there was some integration, for the most part, white people stayed off and did their own thing. Black people stayed off and did their own thing. There was very little mixing for a number of reasons and precautions and safety measures. So, you know, he didn't really come in contact with that many black people. So there was a little bit of an aloofness, this kind of mystery of, well, here's a teammate, but I've never actually spent this much time with somebody like him before. And there are some stories that say that, you know, it was instilled in him at a young age that there was, you know, a lot of maliciousness against black people and he needed to respect black people. And, you know, again, it's various stories. But if there's one thing that can be, you know, put down as truth, Pee Wee Reese, remember in 1947, he was a pretty veteran player at the time. He had been in the league since 1940. And here comes this young, very athletic, incredible ball player in Jackie Robinson, who could play shortstop. Now, Robinson spent most of his career at second base, but he also played shortstop. In fact, in Montreal with the Royals, he played shortstop for much of that season in 1946. And he could also play at first base. So it was looking pretty obvious in 1947 that Robinson might make the major league roster. Well, if you're Pee Wee Reese, maybe you're thinking less about, oh, it's a black guy taking a white guy's job. But it was more of, hey, I'm a shortstop and he can play shortstop too. And okay. So there was some distance early on because from all accounts that I've read, because, you know, Reese was more concerned about just losing his job, never mind any kind of race relations going on. So eventually the Dodgers decide to put Robinson at first base at first. And again, later on, he would play second base. But, you know, once the threat of losing his job went away, Reese was able to kind of lighten up just a little bit. Okay, I'm not going to lose my job. Here's a teammate here. And he was, again, very well aware about some of the pressures that Robinson was going to face. And there is a very infamous moment early in the 1947 season, as Robinson is just taking, you know, all sorts of verbal abuse over and over and over again. Pee Wee Reese made his mark and really sent a sign that has since been recreated in statue form. And this was back in April of 1947. The Dodgers go out to Cincinnati, and Cincinnati, even though it's in Ohio, and people think, well, Ohio, that's a northern state. Cincinnati has had a lot of race relation issues over the centuries. And the fans in Cincinnati were, to put it nicely, giving Robinson a hard time. So during the pregame infield warmup at Crosley Field, Reese goes over to Robinson and he starts talking to him. And the two eventually, start walking across the field together, and Reese puts his arm around Robinson's shoulders, and they're walking back to the dugout. And all of a sudden, this is groundbreaking. You know, again, this is 1947 in much of the nation. You know, it was very unusual just to have black people and white people working together, being in the same space as one another, touching one another was very faux pas in a lot of societies. But to have a white guy and a black guy be arm in arm, friend to friend, teammate to teammate, and in the grander scheme of things, American to American, man to man, human to human, this was a very, very stunning act, which Reese had downplayed throughout his entire life. But he was one of the first players to embrace Robinson's role with the team. And again, it's not like he went running across the field and said, hey, give me a big hug here. Come on, you big, I mean, some people nowadays, you'd do something like that merely for the photo op. But this was something where, Reese saw the abuse that Robinson was taking, especially from fans in opposing stadiums. And he was able to quell that with this very simple gesture. And even though it was simple, it was earth-shattering in 1947. So it's a very neat thing that Reese did. And then Reese and Robinson had a very long, lifelong friendship, for many, many years. And Pee Wee Reese was the first Dodger. And it's not like he was trying to make a national statement. I mean, it kind of turns out that way. But at the time, I think he's trying to show his teammates, hey, Jackie is one of us, and we're going to win and lose together, as a team. Because remember, too, the Dodgers had some players who didn't like having Jackie Robinson on their team. Dixie Walker is one of the best examples. I mean, with a nickname like Dixie, what more do you need to know? But if you ever read Roger Kahn's The Boys of Summer, there's another great baseball book, by the way. If you ever read The Boys of Summer, you'll get a great background into not only Robinson's time with the Dodgers, but also trying to work through some of the racism that he faced from his own teammates. And Pee Wee Reese was one guy who was just through his gestures and through his very practical approach to this new player on the ball club, he was able to quell a lot of that issue within the locker room. And then the Dodgers, as they started putting prejudices aside and they saw how really good of a player Jackie Robinson was, what do you know? They get to the pennant that year, and you can very easily become a fan of this teammate, regardless of whatever your upbringing was or whatever differences you had. So it was a very seminal moment in the early parts of the 1947 season in a very hostile environment. And Pee Wee Reese was able to do that simply by putting his arm over the shoulder of his teammate. Not only does The Boys of Summer cover this real well, but Jackie Robinson's autobiography, which has since been re-released after the release of the movie 42 a couple years ago, it's called I Never Had It Easy. That is a great book. If you want the perspective of what Jackie Robinson went through his own eyes and through his words, I highly, highly recommend you read that. Now, one other fun note about Pee Wee Reese, other than his nickname, and like I said, there are some interesting stories about, you know, how he got his nickname. But the consensus is, you know, he was a really good marbles player when he was growing up in the 1920s. And the peewee is the smaller marble of the bunch. So some say it has to deal with him being a really good marbles player when he was a kid. Others say because he was generously listed at 5'9 and a half and 178 pounds during his playing days because he was smaller than others. That's how he got his nickname. Well, an interesting fact, even though Pee Wee Reese was a Dodger for life in terms of major league appearances, he was actually property of the Boston Red Sox. This is just amazing. The Red Sox in 1938 decided to buy the minor league club called the Louisville Colonels. And Reese had worked his way onto the Colonels, even though he hadn't played organized baseball until he was much later in life. In fact, a senior in high school is what really got him going in his career. You know, this was a guy, he was going to be a factory worker. You know, this was not, you know, Major League Baseball was really not in the cards for him, at least in his mind, growing up in Louisville, Kentucky. Well, he catches on with a local rec league, which wins the local league championship, and the Louisville Colonels basically just give him a tryout, and of course, he lights up the world there. So, you know, the Red Sox buy the Colonels ball club, so now they own the rights to Pee Wee Reese, and they're going to make him the shortstop of the future there. Well, Joe Cronin, who was the manager of the Red Sox at the time, was also the shortstop at the time. Not all that unusual at the time to have player managers. Lou Boudreau, one of the more famous ones with the Cleveland Indians in the 1940s. Well, Joe Cronin was in that position in 1938. So the Red Sox brass send Cronin down to Louisville to scout out some of their players. And Cronin sees how good Pee Wee Reese is, and he's fearing for his job. So he sends this really bad scouting report back to Tom Yawkey, the Red Sox owner, and basically suggests that they trade Reese. So the Red Sox eventually, in the summer of 1939, they send Reese to Brooklyn for four players to be named later and $35,000. So while Joe Cronin saves his job, Pee Wee Reese would be yet another one who got away for the Red Sox. Of course, the Babe Ruth trade to the Yankees is probably the worst in their franchise history, but you can argue that this is probably top three or four because Reese had a very long and productive career in the major leagues. Now, the irony is, while Joe Cronin was afraid of losing his job to Pee Wee Reese, another player manager who played shortstop, Leo Durocher, in Brooklyn, would lose his job to Reese, but apparently Durocher was okay with it. Of course, he was a pretty decent manager later on in his pro career. So another one that got away, a very fun story about Pee Wee Reese, who was, you know, by accident became part of the Red Sox organization and by jealousy was pushed out to the Brooklyn Dodgers because Joe Cronin just could not imagine giving up his position to this little kid coming out of the backwoods of Louisville, Kentucky. It's a pretty amazing story. And it's all encaptured in this pretty amazing card. Yes, it's beaten up, but you know what? So was Brooklyn. Brooklyn was not the fancy pinstripes of the Yankees. They were not the, you know, the glorious old powerhouse of the New York Giants. They were Brooklyn. They were blue collar. They were the Dodgers. They were the bums. They were the team that always had to wait until next year. Well, next year finally came in 1955. And this card in 1957 has been through the grinder, quite possibly literally, but I absolutely love it. And it's not the best example of the 1957 top set, but it's an example of a piece of history that's been able to hold up for over 60 years, featuring the late, great Henry Pee Wee Reese. Well, there's my thoughts about 57 Tops and also the Pee Wee Reese career, a Hall of Famer who was inducted via the Veterans Committee in 1984. If you want to talk about Pee Wee Reese, the Dodgers, the 57 Tops set, or anything about the hobby, you can do so again on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. All right, our next set is 1958 Tops, and I don't have a random pull in this set because I only have one 58 Tops card. But it's a very interesting player, And it's a very interesting story about how I acquired that card as well. It came from a very unexpected source, and I'm glad I found it because it really opened up my world to the cards of pre-1973. I was able to get my hands on this when I was about 15 years old, and I've had it ever since. It's a pretty card, a nice set too, and continue the dominance of Topps in the hobby. We'll talk about that next Tuesday. Don't forget a Flashback Friday edition coming your way this Friday via Audio Boom and iTunes. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for listening to another edition of Wax Ecstatic.